And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, September the 8th, 251st day of the year. Leap years, it's 252. 114 days left until the end of the year. On this date in the year 617, the Battle of Huy. Li Yuan defeats a Sui dynasty army, opens the path to his capture of the imperial capital of Chang'an and the eventual establishment of the Tang dynasty. 1100 AD, election of Antipope Theodoric. Somebody asked me in an email what Antipope. Theodoric was anti-pope in 1100 and 1101. Clement III was anti-pope. He died September 8th in 1100. And his followers met in Rome secretly at night at St. Peter's Basilica, where they elected and enthroned Theodorico, the Bishop of Albano, and who went then by the name of Theodoric. Forced to abandon Rome, he was seized 3.5 months later and brought before Pope Pascal II, where he was condemned, declared an anti-pope, and sent to the monastery of La Cava in Salerno, where he died in 1102. Now, interestingly enough, we have popes and anti-popes. Trying to figure out the logic. 1198, Philip of Swabia, Prince of Hohenstaufen, is crowned King of Germany, King of the Romans, so to speak. 1253, Pope Innocent IV canonizes Stanislaus of Czepanow, killed by King Boleslaw II. 1264, the Statute of Calais, who guarantees Jewish safety and personal liberties and gives Bataille Din jurisdiction over Jewish matters, is promulgated by Boleslaw the Pious, Duke of Greater Poland. 1276, Pope John the 21st is chosen. 1331, Stefan Dusan declares himself King of Serbia. 1380, Battle of Kulikovo. Russian forces defeat a mixed army of Tartars and Mongols, stop their advance into the European area. 1504, Michelangelo's David is unveiled in Piazza della Signoria in Florence. 1514, the Battle of Orsha. One of the biggest battles of the century, Lithuanians and Poles defeat the Russian army. 1522, Magellan, Elcano circumnavigation. The Victoria arrives in Seville, technically completed the first circumnavigation of the world. 1565. St. Augustine, Florida is founded by Spanish Admiral, Florida's first governor, Pedro Menendez de Aviles. 1565. Knights of Malta lift the Ottoman siege of Malta that began May 18th. 1655, the Warsaw falls without resistance to a small force under the command of Charles X, Gustav of Sweden, during the deluge, making it the first time the city was ever captured by a foreign army. 1727, a barn fire starts during a puppet show in the village of Burwell in Cambridgeshire in England, kills 78, many of them are children. 1755, French and Indian War, Battle of Lake George. 1756, French and Indian War. Katanging Expedition. For those that are not familiar with what that is, also known as the Armstrong Expedition. It was a raid during the French and Indian War that led to the destruction of the American Indian village of Katanging that had served as a staging point for attacks by the Delaware warriors against colonists in the British province of Pennsylvania. Commanded by Lieutenant Colonel John Armstrong, this raid deep into hostile territory was the only major expedition carried out by the Pennsylvania provincial troops during a brutal backcountry war. Early on the morning of September 8, 1756, they launched a surprise attack on the village, literally overwhelmed it. And although it eventually became a worldwide conflict known as the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War began on the Pennsylvania frontier as a struggle for control of the Ohio country. The surrender of George Washington at Fort Necessity in 1754 and Braddock's defeat in 1755, settlers on the Pennsylvania frontier were without professional military protection, so they organized their own defense force. French allied Indians who defeated General Braddock at the Monongahela were primarily from the Great Lakes region to the north. The local Indians, mostly Delaware and Shawnee, who had come into that area after white colonists settled their lands to the east, had waited to see who's going to win. They didn't want to side with the loser. With the Fort Duquesne now secured, the victorious French encouraged the Delaware and Shawnee to take up the hatchet against those who had taken their land. So they began to raid. And that led to this attack. 1761, the marriage of King George III of the UK to Duchess Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz. 1775, the unsuccessful raising of the priest in Malta. Now, for those who are not familiar with the rising of the priest, as it was called, also known as the Maltese Rebellion of 1775 and the Rebellion of September 1775. It was an uprising led by Maltese clergy against the Order of St. John, who'd actually control Malta. The uprising took place on September 8, 1775, but it was suppressed by the order within just a few hours. The rebels were captured and some were executed, exiled, or imprisoned. The causes of the revolt go back to 1773, when Francisco Jimenez de Texada was elected Grand Master on the death of Manuel Pinto de Fonseca. When the newly elected Grand Master took office, he found a depleted treasury, so he introduced austerity measures, reduced spending, and increased the price of corn. So everybody hated him, and that led to the uprising. That didn't go too well. 1781, American Revolution, Battle of Eutaw Springs in South Carolina. The war's last significant battle in the Southern Theater ends in a narrow British tactical victory. 1793, French Revolutionary Wars, Battle of Hanscoot. Took place during the Flanders Campaign of 1793. Fought during operations surrounding the Siege of Dunkirk at Hunscoot Nord, France, resulted in a French victory under General Jean-Nicolas Houchard and General Jean-Baptiste Jordan against the command of Marshal Freytag, part of the Anglo-Hanoverian Corps of the Duke of York. So the French didn't always surrender if anybody looked at them wrong. 1796, Battle of Bassano. French forces defeat Austrian troops at Bassano da Grappa. 1810, the Tonquin sets sail from New York Harbor. 33 employees of John Jacob Astor's newly created Pacific Fur Company on board. After a six-month journey to around the tip of South America, the ship arrived at the mouth of the Columbia River. And Astor's men established the fur trading town of Astoria in Oregon. 1831, William IV and Adelaide of Saxe-Meiningen, the crown king and queen of the UK, of Great Britain and Ireland. Also in 1831, the November Uprising. The Battle of Warsaw effectively ended the Polish insurrection. 1860, the steamship P.S. Lady Elgin sinks on Lake Michigan. Around 300 die. 1862, Millennium of Russia monument is unveiled in Novgorod. 1863, the American Civil War. Second Boundless Sabine Pass, a small Confederate force thwarts a Union invasion of Texas. 1883, the Northern Pacific Railway was completed in a ceremony at Gold Creek, Montana. Ulysses S. Grant, the former president, drove in the final golden spike in an event attended by rail and political luminaries. 1888, Isaac Peril's submarine is first tested. 1888, in London, the body of Jack the Ripper's official second victim, Annie Chapman, is found. Also in 1888, in England, the first six football league matches are played. 1892, the Pledge of Allegiance is first recited. 1900, Galveston hurricane. Powerful hurricane hits Galveston, Texas, kills about 8,000 people. 1905, a 7.2 Calabria earthquake shakes southern Italy with a maximum Mercalli intensity of 11. Kills between 557 and 2,500 people, depending on who you talk to. 1914, World War I. Private Thomas Highgate becomes the first British soldier to be executed for desertion during that war. 1916, in a bid to prove women were capable of serving as military dispatch riders, Augusta and Adeline Van Buren arrive in Los Angeles, completing a 60-day, 5,500-mile cross-country trip on motorcycles. 1921, Margaret Gorman, a 16-year-old, wins the Atlantic City Pageant's Golden Mermaid Trophy. Pageant officials later called her the first Miss America. 1923, Honda Point disaster. 9 U.S. Navy destroyers run aground off the California coast. 7 are lost and 23 sailors are killed. 1925, the Rif War. Spanish forces, including troops from the Foreign Legion under Colonel Francisco Franco, landing at Al Hoceima, Morocco. 1926, Germany's admitted to the League of Nations. 1930, 3M begins marketing Scotch transparent tape. 1933, Ghazi bin Faisal becomes king of Iraq. 1934, off the New Jersey coast, a fire on board the passenger liner SS Morro Castle kills 137 people. 1935, Huey Long, senator from Louisiana, fatally shot in the Louisiana State Capitol building. 1941, German forces begin the siege of Leningrad. 1943, the Armistice of Casabao is proclaimed by radio. Hobby Sud immediately implements plans to disarm the Italian forces. 1944, London is hit by a V-2 rocket for the first time. 1945, the division of Korea begins when U.S. troops arrive to partition the southern part of Korea in response to Soviet troops occupying the northern part of the peninsula a month earlier. 1946, a referendum abolishes the monarchy in Bulgaria. 1952, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation makes its first televised broadcast on the second escape of the Boyd Gang. And for those who are not familiar with the Boyd Gang, it's a notorious criminal gang based in Toronto, Canada, named for member Edwin Alonzo Boyd. It was a favorite of the media at the time because of their sensational actions that included bank robberies, jail breaks, and relationships with beautiful women, gunfights, manhunts, and escapes. Well, all four men were placed in side-by-side cells in the Don Jail. On September 8, 1952, they managed to escape for a second time with the help of another saw blade smuggled in by a lawyer. Can't trust lawyers. That night, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's first television newscast, anchored by Lauren Green and produced by Harry Raske, detailed the escape. The jail's warden was suspended, and a $26,000 reward was offered for information leading to their arrest. 10 days later, they were discovered hiding in a barn about a mile south of Shepherd Avenue and Leslie Street after Willie Jackson went to Youngest Street and Shepherd in North York to buy food and cigarettes. Well, This just goes to show you just cannot trust lawyers. All righty. In 1954, the Southeast Asia Treaty Organization, CETO, was established. 1916, Huntsville, Alabama, President Eisenhower formally dedicates the Marshall Space Flight Center. NASA had been activated, had activated a facility on July 1st. 1962, last run of the famous Pines Express over the Somerset and Dorset Railway line, fittingly using the last steam locomotive built by the British Railways. 1966, the landmark American science fiction TV series Star Trek premiered for its first episode. It's called The Man Trap. 1970, Transinternational Airlines Flight 863 crashes during takeoff from JFK International Airport in New York City, killing all 11 people on board. 1971, in Washington, D.C., JFK Center for the Performing Arts is inaugurated, with the opening feature being the premiere of Leonard Bernstein's Mass. 1974, the Watergate scandal. U.S. President Gerald Ford signs the pardon of Richard Nixon for any crimes Nixon may have committed while in office. 1975, gays in the military. U.S. Air Force Technical Sergeant Leonard Matlevich, decorated veteran of the Vietnam War, appears in his Air Force uniform on the cover of Time magazine with the headline, "I'm a homosexual." He was immediately given a general discharge, which was later upgraded to honorable. 1978, Black Friday, a massacre by soldiers against protesters in Tehran, resulted in between 700 to 3,000 deaths, depending on who you talk to. Marked the beginning of the end of the monarchy in Iran. 1988, Yellowstone National Park is closed for the first time in U.S. history due to ongoing fires. 1989, Partner Flight 394 dives into the North Sea, kills 55 people. An investigation showed the tail of the plane vibrated loose in flight due to substandard connecting bolts that had been fraudulently sold as aircraft grade. 1991, Republic of Macedonia becomes independent. 1994, U.S. Air Flight 427 on approach to Pittsburgh International Airport suddenly crashes in clear weather, killed all 132 on board, resulted in the most extensive aviation investigation in world history and the altering of the manufacturing processes in the industry. 2004, NASA's unmanned spacecraft Genesis crash lands when its parachute fails to open. 2005, two Illusion 2-76 aircraft from Emmercon landed at a disaster aid staging area in Little Rock Air Force Base. First time Russia had flown such a mission to North America. And in 2016, NASA launches OSIRIS-REx, its first asteroid sample return mission. The probe was going to visit 101955 Bennu and is expected to return with samples in 2023. Assuming there's anybody here to see them. Well, there's a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian feast days. Adrian and Natalia of Nicodemia, Roman Catholic Church. Corbinian, Decebad, Nativity of Mary in the Roman Catholic Church. Mont Fest in the Mangalorean Catholic Church. Our Lady of Charity. Our Lady of Covadonga. Our Lady of Good Health of Valenciennes. Pope Sergius I. Feast day of Our Lady of Mariscal. National holiday in Andorra. Earliest day on which Auditor's Day can fall. September 14th is the latest. Celebrates on the second Sunday in September. Church of Scientology. Earliest day on which the day of the workers in the oil, gas, power, and geological industry can fall. September 14th is the latest. This is celebrated in Turkmenistan on the second Saturday in September. In Estonia, this is the earliest date on which Grandparents' Day can fall. September 14th is the latest. Also celebrated on the second Sunday in September. In China, in the Chinese diaspora, earliest day on which Mid-Autumn Festival can fall, October 8th is the latest, celebrated on the 15th day in the 8th month of the Chinese calendar. Earliest day on which Turkmen Bayramı Day can fall. While September 14th is the latest, celebrated on the second Sunday in September in Turkmenistan. In Russia, it's the day of the Battle of Borodino. Feast of Izat, first day of the 10th month in the Baha'i calendar, in the Baha'i faith. Independence Day in Macedonia celebrates its independence from Yugoslavia in 1991. International Literacy Day, Martyrs' Day in Afghanistan. National Day, also the Feast of Our Lady of Mariksal in Andorra. Victory Day in Pakistan. Victory Day, also the Feast of Our Lady of Victories in Malta. And World Physical Therapy Day. Well, with all that having been said, and that was a lot, let me tell you, we're talking about more strange encounters. You know, sometimes, and it seems to have something to do with the way the brain is wired, some people see something and others don't. And Alf Burns was a man who attracted attention wherever he went. Although he was a wealthy scrap merchant in Swinton, Yorkshire, he could hardly have been called an elegantly dressed person. He was, if you want to be kindly, he was eccentric. His usual clothes were an old pair of trousers, rubber boots, usually different sizes, a ragged shirt, a faded jacket, and a top hat that had once belonged to an undertaker. And to top this off, he always carried a shiny, tapering swagger stick with a silver handle. Well, some of the local boys loved to harass him. They were the bane of his life. Although he was able to lock up his scrapyard at night, it was easy enough for him to climb over the walls. And sometimes he caught him, and he'd chase after him, waving his stick in the air angrily. So when he died in 1936, the town lost a character who could never be replaced. Left his business to his brother, Ted, who was neither eccentric nor colorful. He always looked clean and smart, even in his overalls. And there just wasn't the same atmosphere about the place after Alf died. Well, Ted had the same trouble with people breaking in, and not only young boys, but he didn't feel like hanging around the yard all the time to try to catch them. At the same time, the problem did worry him, especially one day when he picked up a valuable load of lead, only to find the next day somebody had raided the yard during the night and stolen the entire load. That represented a lot of money. Well, the problem of security at the scrapyard was taken out of his hands in a way that Ted never could have imagined possible. See, four local boys climbed into the yard one night, but they left a whole lot faster than they came in and raced off home. And the next day, the entire town knew that the boys had seen Alf Burns himself in the yard, and he'd wave his stick at them. Absolutely no doubt in their minds that it had been Alf. Queer clothes, top hat and all. Some of the other boys, though, laughed at the tale the four were telling, and one night later, two of those non-believers climbed into the scrapyard on their own. Well, no sooner had their feet hit the ground than they saw old Alf. And he spotted them, charged at him, waving his stick in the air. Well, they literally vaulted over that fence. And news of these two strange incidents soon reached Ted, and following everybody knew that old Alf had returned to haunt the scrapyard. And this suited Ted just fine, because it solved his big security problem. But he was a down-to-earth man who was certain it must have been something else that had scared the kids. So he's going to find out for himself what it was. So he went back to the yard one night and climbed over the wall and almost fainted at what he saw. Because there, was big as life, was his dead brother Alf strolling up and down the yard. For a long time, Ted never told anybody what he'd seen that night, but later on, several people passing the yard late at night swore they'd seen Alf's ghost peering at him through the fence. He finally admitted he'd seen it too. Even in death, Alf continued to protect his property. And certainly, a ghost in the night watchman is not going to ask for a raise. You know, we used to go to estate sales a lot. And I went to one. This was the wife's death. The husband had been a high-ranking military officer. And among the stuff was a swagger stick. Not the one he usually carried, but another he'd been presented. And I enjoyed it, and I put it on a display. And somebody came to the house and saw it and insisted I name a price, they'd pay it, whatever it was. Well, I didn't want to sell it, so I named a price all right. And he paid it without question. And then I got the story back. He'd been seen wandering through Walmart, swagger stick under his arm, looking proud as punch. Well, if ever a man had a terrifying experience, it was Jake Quinn. He was a farm worker who lived near Gorn Haven in Cornwall. And he was hardly an imaginative person. He was a simple man who liked his work and enjoyed pottering around his small garden during his free time. Well, then one day in May of 1899, Jake was sitting on the harbor wall in the village, watching the ships, when he was joined by his cousin, Ronnie Small. Now, Jake didn't spend much time with his cousin, because he thought Ronnie was rather full of his own importance. And as usual, they got into an argument. Jake was happy enough with the way things were, but Ronnie wanted him to join him in a venture on his fishing boat. Ronnie was leaving on his boat that afternoon, and suddenly Jake felt afraid. And his surprise, he shortly found himself trying to prevent his cousin from going out to sea that day. He didn't have the least idea what prompted him to do it, but Ronnie just laughed at the arguments and said he had no time to waste when there was money to be made. And when Ronnie was ready to put out to sea, Jake walked down to the harbor to see him off. Ronnie didn't make any comment, but it was clear he was puzzled by Jake's sudden concern. And later that evening, Jake heard somebody in the village talking. He said it was such a storm a moment ago, I never saw such thunder and lightning. They say back in the bay there was a gale and a wind at sea. Well, walking back home, Jake saw plenty of signs of that storm. Tiles and chimney pots were scattered all over the road. As he walked past the churchyard, he saw three men carrying a coffin, and he wondered who would have died. As the men tried to cross a rough patch in the road, they seemed to be having trouble with the coffin's weight and almost dropped it. So being the helpful sort, Jake went over and helped them by taking the weight to one corner. When they got to the churchyard, the men set the coffin down on the ground, and one after the other they thanked him. And at that moment, the clouds parted and the moon lit up the graveyard, and Jake saw the nameplate on the coffin. Nameplate said Ronnie Small, age 27, drowned off Gorn Bay. Well, Jake couldn't make out the date, for the print was too small, but he almost, in spite of himself, he said, "Would you credit that? I got a cousin named Ronnie Small, and he's just the same age." And then at that moment, Jake took a closer look at the three coffin bearers and realized he knew them. They were all fishermen he knew to have been drowned more than a year before. Well, he didn't say what happened after that, but needless to say, he made himself scarce. Then a few days later, Ronnie's boat was found floating upside down at sea just off the bay. Ronnie's body was found a few miles along the beach. Drown. Well, it was a dark, stormy night. That's how a lot of stories begin, don't you know? Dark, stormy night in 1900 when Seamus O'Halloran walked along the road on the last few miles to his house in Crumlin in County Antrim. After 3 years living in London, he was so glad to be back in Ireland, he refused the offer to stay overnight with a friend in Belfast. Instead, he hitched a ride from a Pac-Man. The journey from Belfast to the nearest town to Crumlin had taken him most of the day with the slow-moving horses, so it was late at night when Seamus left the Pac-Man and set out on the last lap of his journey home. But he'd gone no more than a half a mile along the road to Crumlin when he heard the sound of a horse moving behind him. Glancing around, he saw a shadowy, fast-moving pony and trap coming toward him. Thinking maybe he wouldn't have to walk the rest of the way, after all, he stood out in the road and waved the vehicle down. He asked the driver, "You happen to be going through Crumlin?" The driver didn't say a word, so Seamus added, "I'll be happy of a lift, and I'll be happy to pay you for it." Well, the driver still didn't say anything, so Seamus, thinking the man to be very unsociable at best, jumped onto the cart, and without a word, the driver whipped up his horse and began an experience which Seamus would have been happier to have missed. The cart rolled along at such a breakneck speed that Seamus had to cling for dear life. In fact, he began to fear they would never arrive at the end of their journey. Every time the flimsy wheel struck a pothole or a stone, the cart bounced several feet in the air before it crashed down again with a frightening lurch. Sparks flew from the wheels as they careened madly uphill and down dale without slowing down the wild pace. Before long, Seamus was sure the driver was drunk, and he begged the man to slow down, but the driver didn't pay him any attention. He just whipped his horse and drove as fast and as reckless as ever. Then Seamus noticed the driver's untidy beard and the long hair that was being blown in his face. To Seamus' horror, the man made no attempt to brush the hair from his eyes. He just drove blindly on and on and on. And several times they almost overturned, as sometimes the wheels came pretty close to the edge of the rough road, almost spilling Seamus into the fields far below. Well, finally, Seamus couldn't stand it anymore, and he jumped out of the cart. Well, he was shaken and bruised, but at the same time, he was relieved to be alive, and he walked the rest of the way home. Explained to his family that Seamus had experienced some sort of shock. He was trembling like a leaf, white-faced and covered with mud, so Seamus told him about the nightmare ride he'd experienced until he'd risk his neck by jumping to safety. He added he'd left his suitcase on the cart. Then when Seamus described the driver, everybody just stared at him. Then his family told him the man he'd described could only have been one person, old Patrick Dooley. You know, Seamus turned pale because he'd heard the legend of Patrick Dooley. Man had been killed over 30 years before when he'd driven his pony cart recklessly through a storm and crashed into a tree. Next morning, Seamus's experience came back to him. His brother was cycling along the road when he found Seamus's suitcase. It was laying in the ditch at just a few feet from the tree that had killed Patrick Dooley. For those wondering, nothing in this story tells what happened to the horse. Probably wanted to be elected to Congress. Late one summer's evening in June of 1883, 19-year-old Rose Despard went upstairs to bed. Nobody else at home. Her parents had gone out to dinner in another part of Chelmsford. Well, she'd stayed at home because she was studying for an important examination in the autumn at a medical school. She'd worked hard all evening and felt rather annoyed when somebody knocked at the front door. Well, getting out of bed, she wrapped herself in a dressing gown and went all the way downstairs to answer the door. But when she opened it up, there was nobody there. Something of a spooky feeling because she hadn't been mistaken about the loud knocking that had gone on for several seconds. But when she looked down the shadowy roadway outside, there was nobody in sight. And then suddenly she realized that there was somebody standing behind her inside the house. Looking back over her shoulder, Rose almost fainted because standing at the top of the stairs down which she had just come was a woman. Tall, thin woman dressed in black, holding a lighted candle in one hand. Well, she stared at Rose with a curious smile on her face and then blew out the candle, plunging the stairway into dark. It was after midnight before Mr. and Mrs. Despard returned home from their dinner engagement, and they were alarmed to see Rose, clad in her dressing gown, lying in a faint. Half across the front porchway. Thinking she'd been attacked, Despard armed himself with a loaded cane and searched the house. But they didn't find anybody. And nothing had been disturbed. All that he noticed was the faint odor of smoke, as if a candle had been snuffed out a few minutes before. Well, when her parents heard Rose's story, they were less afraid. They blamed her experience on the fact that she'd been working too hard on her examinations, and they sent her away on a vacation. That night, though, was the first of many when the woman in black was to haunt that house in Chelmsford. First of many nights when they were awakened by a knocking at their front door, by ghostly footsteps on the stairs and in the passages. See, the house had been built in 1860 on the south side of Pittville Circus Road at the corner of All Saints Road. Rose had moved into the house with her father, Captain F.W. Despard, and the family about 2 months before she first saw the ghost. Until they went to live there, the house had been empty for almost 6 years. And Rose wasn't the only person who experienced the weird happenings in that house. More than 20 others, family and friends, had been frightened by inexplicable incidents. After her initial fright, Rose saw the ghost many times during the next 4 years. And over time, she became less afraid, more interested in this strange experience. In fact, she kept a diary in which she recorded every encounter with the ghost. Now, her first meeting with that spirit had been a brief one, and she'd been able to study the ghost in detail, but on other occasions, she was cool enough to observe the phantom woman more closely. This woman, she said, was tall, wore black, and appeared to be soft woolen material. When the ghost moved, there was a faint sound like the rustling of a stiffly starched petticoat. She saw the features of the ghost indistinctly, but could clearly see the forehead and the hair. And the ghost's left hand was practically hidden by the sleeve of her dress. On both wrists, Rose clearly discerned parts of widow's cuffs, so this and the black dress led her to suppose the specter was that of a widow. Now, there was a strange vagueness about the ghost's head, but Rose had got the impression this was because of a bonnet that had a veil attached to it. And Rose's sister also saw the ghost a number of times. One occasion, she was sitting alone in the lounge on a warm evening when she felt an icy cold shiver pass through her body. She looked up and saw the ghost bending over her, looking at with the intention of turning the pages of her book. The sister, whose name was Edith, screamed. The ghost looked surprised and vanished. 1884, the ghost was seen by both sisters in the garden of the house. On another occasion, a charwoman followed the phantom right around the house before it vanished. The ghost seemed to have a set routine, appearing on the upstairs landing, walking down the stairs, coming into the lounge, leaving this room by another door, walking down a passageway, and out through still another door into the garden. The weird noises and the sounds of footsteps were heard by a number of people, but Captain Despard never saw the ghost. Once when Rose saw the ghost come into the lounge from the garden to stand behind a sofa, her father came into the room as well. When she told him the ghost was there, he couldn't see anything. But when he walked to the spot where Rose said the specter was standing, the ghost moved around him and left the room. Well, eventually, this ghostly mourner disappeared. Either the family gotten accustomed to having her around, or she'd gotten accustomed to them. But who she was, where she was from, where she went, nobody ever knew. Nobody could ever find out. Well, you know, one of the most desolate places is said to be the area around Dartmoor. It was a misrouted moorland, said to be one of the loneliest places in England. Only a handful of houses and only a few villages dot that grim area. Now, it's seen many tragedies, and it's the scene of many inexplicable incidents. It's also the site of the halfway house to hell. The gray, lichen-covered walls of this building are probably better known as Dartmoor Prison. It stood on the Winslet Moors for over 200 years. Few of the prisoners who leave there have ever wanted to return. A few who do return have always been sent back against their will. All but one, that is. He was the prisoner everybody called the Shepherd. He was a former sea captain who was imprisoned on the Moor in 1814 for 10 years. It seems he caused the death of several crewmen by beating. Now, this wasn't a rare occurrence in those days, but this man's brutality was such that the relatives of the dead men had protested to the governor. The captain was charged with manslaughter, tried, found guilty, and sent to the Moor. For the first few years, he was a loner, a sullen, resentful prisoner would have nothing to do with his fellow inmates. Even the guards were cautious around him due to his certain outburst of violent temper. And his only friends were the birds. He fed the crumbs through the bars of his cell, and some say some mice. One day, when he was working in a quarry with a gang of other convicts, he spotted a field mouse nest nearby. He baited a trap to catch one of the mice alive. Unfortunately, another prisoner saw what he was doing and tried to claim the mouse. Argument broke out between the men, finally led to what was called a challenge. A tradition at this time, this meant that one man had to back down or fight it out to the bitter end with bare fists and heavy clogs. And it was a tradition that the guards recognized and probably enjoyed as much as their prisoners. But in this instance, it looked as if the captain had bitten off more than he could chew. And although he was a big, heavily muscled man, he was only 5'10". He was in his 50s. His opponent was half his age, almost 6'6", and built like and as strong as an ox. But the smaller man didn't hesitate. He hurled himself at the giant prisoner and knocked him to the ground. Now, the man was surprised but not dazed by the attack. He got up to his feet and went forward to deal with the captain. For more than an hour, they punched and wrestled and kicked with their heavy wooden clogs, and although the smaller prisoner was getting the worst of the battle, he didn't give in. Three times his fellow convicts picked him up, revived him, and hurled him back at the giant. And after the third time, his overconfident opponent dropped his guard. Like lightning, the captain's right fist smashed out, crashed against the bigger man's jaw, and put him on the ground. The fight was over. But when the victor went to pick up the mouse, he discovered that the animal had escaped during the fight. At that, the captain broke down and cried. When this episode reached the prison warden, he arranged for the former seaman to become a shepherd in charge of the prison flock. Soon the shepherd, as he became known, knew every single one of his sheep by separate names. And for the rest of his sentence on the moor, he was devoted to their welfare. Even during the worst winter blizzards, if any of the flock strayed, he'd go off to search for it, usually accompanied by the guard, but sometimes by himself, and every time he found the sheep and brought them back. Well, when the warden sent for him to tell him he'd been released, he started to cry. The warden was used to that. He'd heard even the toughest of convicts weep when they were told they were being sent back to the world outside. But this time, the warden discovered there was a different reason for the tears. The shepherd wanted to stay because he didn't want to leave his flock of sheep. But unfortunately, when your time is up, your time is up. But less than a month later, he was back in Dartmoor for a 20-year sentence. He had been involved in a daring diamond robbery in London. Once again, he was put in charge of the sheep. But a few years later, a prison committee decided they were going to discharge him. By that time, he was almost 60. His health had been broken because of the harsh prison life. Well, again he appealed to the warden to be allowed to stay on because he was happy there with the sheep, but unfortunately the warden couldn't do anything to help him. As the old sick convict was led away, he turned to the warden and said quietly, "I'll be back again, you know. My sheep can't do without me." Well, he went to live with his daughter in Plymouth. And a few weeks later, the warden got word the shepherd had died. On the evening after his death, a patrol of guards challenged the dark figure they glimpsed moving across the French cemetery. That's the grave of prisoners who died there during the Napoleonic Wars. Hearing the challenge, the man stopped and turned, and two of the guards recognized the shepherd standing in the moonlight. Before they could overcome their shock, he slipped into the shadows, running toward the sheep pen. Well, the warden, worried because of the shepherd's ill health, ordered a search to be made, but nobody was found. It was the next morning that the warden was made aware that the shepherd had died at his daughter's home. Well, since then, the shepherd has kept his promise to return time and time again. Dozens of convicts and guards have sworn they've seen his wraith striding over the moor toward the sheep. Others have whispered how his ethereal shape has been seen standing guard over injured sheep or lambing ewes. The shepherd of the moor has become as real to the inmates of Dartmoor Prison as any of their jailers of the grim gray walls of the prison. And there are those that say he really is as real. Well, it's not just the loyalty that an individual feels toward animals such as the shepherd with his sheep. Lucian Landau tossed fretfully about the bed one night in June of 1955. Couldn't sleep. Maybe it was because he was not in his own bed, but in another. But he couldn't deny it was a very comfortable bed. And that didn't seem to be the answer, so he wondered if he'd eaten too much at the dinner his host prepared in his honor. And the more Landau thought about sleep, the less likely he seemed to be able to do it. Finally, he decided to push the matter out of his mind, and sure enough, shortly after that, he dropped off to sleep. But only about an hour later, something woke him up. He woke up to find he's lying on his side, facing a wall, and he had the strange feeling that someone had come into the room. Slowly, cautiously, he turned over and saw a misty patch of light across the room. He felt conscious of a strange tenseness in the atmosphere. And the rest of the room was pitch black around that pillar of white light. Suddenly, he saw a figure materialize in the misty column of light. It was his host's wife, and Landau knew she was dead. She was smiling at him, and her hand was stroking an Alsatian dog that was standing beside her in that beam of light. And Landau heard the woman's ghostly whisper, "Tell Constantine that I've found Brutus." With that, she faded away, and the light disappeared. Landau didn't know what to think. He just lay there, staring in the darkness. Wasn't a sound from the rest of the household. The luminous dial of his watch told him it was a few minutes after 4 in the morning. And there was little sleep for Lucian Landau for the rest of that night. Now, he had never met his host's wife, but he'd heard about her sudden death a few months earlier. That's when he'd met Constantine in London for a business conference. Although he did recognize the face of the woman from a photograph he'd seen, the dog puzzled him, and so did the message. So the morning after he saw the ghost, he asked his host if his wife had ever owned a dog, an Alsatian perhaps. His host was so surprised he jumped up from his chair and crossed to the window. He stood staring for a few minutes before he turned and looked at his guest, and he said, yeah, his wife had owned the dog. The dog's name was Brutus. After his wife's death, he said, the dog had been so unhappy that he boarded it out at the kennels. The dog was still living there. And then cautiously, not really knowing how to open the discussion, Landau asked if he was sure the dog was still alive and told him about what he had seen the night before. Well, his host assured him, as far as he knew, the dog was fine. And Landau asked him if he'd please check up with the kennel to make absolutely sure. But they were not able to get through to the kennel. Wasn't until later that afternoon when they learned the dog had suddenly died a few days earlier. Landau then learned that the guest room where he'd been sleeping had been the dressing room of the host's wife. And the really significant feature in this strange case is that Landau, before seeing the ghost, had no way of knowing she'd possessed a dog. On his visit to the house in Geneva, there'd been absolutely nothing to suggest there'd ever been a dog there, let alone an Alsatian. Thorough investigation into this case by psychic experts confirmed everything but Landau had seen the dog's ghost. This strange experience arouses a number of questions. Why had the host wife appeared to Landau? Maybe he had psychic powers he didn't know about. Certainly the lady wished to assure her husband she is still living after death. But why ask an intermediary? Whatever the true reason, the inexplicable case has convinced the host someday he'd meet his wife and their dog once again. Well, sometimes, for whatever reason, spirits stay around. You know, in 1920, Sir Edward Carson and his wife bought Cleves Court near Minster in Kent. And they had heard shortly after they bought it that the beautiful old house was haunted. Well, like most folks, at first they were inclined to laugh the matter off as being nothing more or less than local superstition. But they soon found out that there was more to the story than that, as some of the most reputable people had experienced something quite uncanny at Cleves Court. One such person was a family physician, Dr. E.G. Moon. One day he surprised Lady Carson by asking her if the ghost had proved to be a nuisance. Lady Carson looked at the doctor rather suspiciously, thinking at first he was teasing her. And then he went on to tell her that one day he had called in to see Lord Carson. On his way out of the house, he had paused at the front door and was astounded to see his car that had been parked in front of the house was gone, along with a thick hedge growing between two sets of gateposts. Instead of the lane he had driven down, there was a muddy cart track. Walking along this was a man wearing a coat with many capes, a short top hat, and gaiters. This apparition stared at the doctor, was able to believe his own eyes, and hurried back into the house. A few minutes later, he looked out again, and there sat his car. The lane was all back as it was supposed to be. After that incident, Lady Carson was unable to deny even to herself that there were weird things happening there. She recalled on her first day there when her husband and she were in their bedroom, they heard a persistent tap at the door. Lord Carson opened the door and put anybody there. Some days later, a friend who was staying with him was disturbed late at night by the sounds overhead of something being dragged across the floor and the drawers being slammed shut. In the morning, the guest asked Lady Carson if the noises might have been made by a servant, but Lady Carson said there was no bedroom above the one in which the visitor slept. Now, part of Cleve Court was built in Henry VII's reign. Then the Elizabethan section was added, and finally the new part. The oldest part of the house was used as servants' quarters. Then their son Edward, who was only 5 at the time, startled his mother, by telling her he didn't like the lady who walked about the passage outside his nursery at night. And Lady Carson tried not to sound too concerned and asked, "Who is this lady? What's she like?" He said, "I don't know. She only walks away." But after this, a night lamp was left burning in the passage. Then Patricia Miller, a 4-year-old niece of Lord Carson, stayed in the bedroom at the house in the Elizabethan part. And she began talking about the lady who came and stood beside her bed at night. One evening she pointed and said, "There she is," and Lady Carson saw nobody. Well, this particular bedroom became known as the ghost room. Not even the dogs would go near it, and the servants were afraid to go anywhere near it at night. Another child was a frequent guest at the house was Joanna Wilson. And she often asked, "Is that poor lady still there? The one who keeps walking in and out of my room? Nobody speaks to her but me." Questioned further, the child told how she'd seen the lady walking in and out of the drawing room as well. And it wasn't until 1922 that Lady Carson learned of the story of the ghost from an old man who lived in the neighboring village of Moncton. Phantom was supposed to be the spirit of an heiress who in life was unhappily married. She lived at Cleve Court when on her marriage the house had become her husband's property, as was the custom at the time. And he had an extension built on the Elizabethan part of the house against her wishes, and when the couple had a violent quarrel, he had locked her in one of the rooms. woman was very unhappy. She had wanted children, but her husband had not, and after her death, she haunted the house. Strangely enough, she's usually seen by children, though adults often heard her walking. It wasn't until 1949 when Lady Carson finally saw the ghost herself. When she was going downstairs and accidentally switched off the light. At the foot of the stairs, her dog ran back up to her, frightened and whimpering. Lady Carson turned on the lights again and saw a woman coming down the stairs. She's wearing a dress with a full gray skirt almost to her ankles, a piece of white lace in her hair, and had a pale gray shawl on. She looked young and real. But it wasn't until the stranger walked through a closed door that Lady Carson shuddered, realizing she'd finally seen the ghost that had long haunted Cleve Court. Well, you know, if there's one house in the world where ghosts are comfortably accommodated, it has to be the 11th century manor house at Sanford, Dorcas, in Dorset. Because with 7 rooms on the premises, there's 7 ghosts. This house was purchased by Colonel Francis Claridge, an industrial chemist who had been researching for a cure for cancer for more than 10 years at the time he bought the house. His work occupied so much of the time, he moved away from London to the seclusion of rural Dorset just before Christmas of 1966. He wanted to be able to continue his research without too many distractions. Unfortunately, he wasn't to enjoy the peace and tranquility he'd been expecting because since he and his wife moved into the house, they'd been haunted by a gaggle of ghosts. There's the artistically minded ghost who sits sometimes for hours on end in an empty room above the derelict gatehouse, playing beautifully sad music from a harpsichord. The harpsichord itself is as ethereal as the ghost itself. One evening, a guest of the colonel's who thought the whole thing was a hoax decided to unmask the culprit for good, so he crept into the tumble-down gatehouse in the dark. Creeping up the worn stone stairs, he paused outside the room and listened. Sure enough, the music was being played inside that room, and faintly he could hear a woman's voice humming softly to the harpsichord. But when he threw the door open and stepped inside, there was nobody there. But the music, which was beyond any doubt being played right there in that room in front of him, became almost deafening before it suddenly stopped. And then there's the ghost that inhabits the middle bedroom of the house. This was first noticed one evening when Miss Claridge's sister was sleeping there during a holiday. Walking into her bedroom, she could smell strong, fragrant pipe smoke. Wondering who was there, she glanced around and saw a cloud of smoke hovering above an armchair placed in front of the windows. Even as she noticed this, she saw a long jet of smoke being blown from the chair. But when she walked around the chair, it was empty. There was nobody else in the room, just her and that drifting cloud of smoke. She was so surprised, she didn't say a thing about the incident till the following afternoon. That was when Miss Claridge came downstairs and asked her sister how long she'd been smoking. His sister denied that, and so the two women went back into the bedroom, and they both noticed the unmistakable aroma of rich, cigar-like tobacco. There was nobody except the two women in the house at the time, as the Colonel Claridge had been staying in London overnight on business. And neither Miss Claridge nor her sister had ever been known to smoke. Then there's the ubiquitous spirit that's that of the old bent woman who'd been seen on several instances, walking slowly up the stairs from the main hallway. She's always heard muttering angry to herself, leaning on the stout walking stick and pulling herself up by the banister. When she reaches the landing, she glances back down the stairs, sighs deeply, and then vanishes. Then there's the man ghost who wears a fairly modern, light-colored lounge suit. He's been seen many times, generally there are several people together in the house. First time he appeared at the Claridge's and her guest was at their Christmas party. Several people noticed him walking among the guests, a sad, anxious expression on his face as if he's looking for somebody special. Wouldn't realize he was really a ghost until that evening when a London journalist was helping his wife look for her coat in the upstairs dressing room. Glancing around, they both saw the man peering in at him through the open window. Suddenly seeing him there and realizing they'd seen him, he vanished, and they thinking he must have fallen, dashed to the window and looked out to the driveway 20 feet below. There was nobody there. Well, we'll finish the story of the ghost of this interesting English manor tomorrow. Till then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.